Hi, everyone. It's Sam and Gary doing another campfire conversation, and we are really excited about having John Blaze with us once again. John, I bump into John off and on, and we had more time together when I was turning my manuscript in for It's Your Call, and so we would talk about things as he did some of the edits and as we worked through the process. And but lately, we bump into each other occasionally, and specifically at a retreat that we helped do for Vance Brown, who you've heard on Campfire Conversations with the Band of Brothers Ministry and the Bear Trap Ranch Retreat Center. And it's just always good to see John again. And it was, and so reading his newest book that I've been telling you about and giving you the link to on Amazon and showing you the picture of the cover, reading that, especially today, spending a couple hours finishing the book, it was just like sitting with John again. Again, what he writes is how he lives and how he speaks and how he, and it's just how he is. And that's what's so much fun about this book. So, John, thank you for doing this campfire conversation with us.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Gary and Sam. Thank you all for having me on.
So, okay, let me start with this question.
Okay.
You wrote this book, you finished the book about a year ago, but how did you come to the place of wanting to write this particular book that you wrote, this one called Know When to Hold 'Em?
I had wanted to do, well, I tell you, fathering is probably, being a father and being a husband, those are the two primary roles in my life. Work, friendships, you know, hobbies or whatever those may be, those things are on down the list. So I got to a point where I could be a little bit reflective about the lives of my kids as they were younger. And as I mentioned to you guys earlier, these stories are all from days that are long gone now, when my kids were drinking out of sippy cups, you know, and being buckled into car seats and stuff. But I reached that point where they were moving away a little bit from me in a good way, which means they were growing up. They'd hit their teens and that kind of stuff. So I had the opportunity to be reflective and think back about some of those stories, and I didn't want to lose those stories. I take notes, you know, from time to time about different things. And so I had kind of a general outline or sketches of these stories. So I went back to try to fill in the blanks, and initially it started as something just to have for my kids. But shared that with a publisher. That was actually about 2.5 years ago, and she said, "You know what? You ought to turn that into a book. I think we could make that work." And that conversation continued, and signed with Abingdon Press. They're a publishing house out of Nashville, Tennessee, and a lady by the name of Lil Copan worked with me, and you've got the finished product there that you were reading today. So,
yeah. It's a great book, and you are, honestly, you are a great storyteller. I mean, I just, you know, sometimes I'm tempted to go, okay, I've read enough of the story, I'm going to go to the next story, next chapter, and I couldn't do it. And plus, though you're elaborative in your story, you're also concise. You know, it's not one of the stories where you go, please, can we come to the end of this? It's not at all. You just did a great job with it. So,
Well, thank you very much.
I want to read just a part here and just ask you to talk about this. Now, you've told a story about you and your son, but I kind of want to start in this, where you said, and I realize I'm jumping in the middle of something, but you said,
"That's okay."
Maybe as he swings, you're talking about pushing him on a swing and talking to him, you said, maybe as he swings, I'll hum a little tune myself, a collection of notes I've assembled from the moment, a song of the boy on the edge of his quest, swinging back toward me for strength and clarity about powerful things and swinging away from me to the world of boys. And then you said, as I envision that moment in my head, I like my placement. I am behind him. I don't want to get in the way of his story playing itself out because it's his story, not mine. But I want to be there, close by, close enough to respond and for him to hear me singing, swing away, swing away. First of all, that's such a beautiful picture, that metaphor of pushing him on a swing. You know, he comes back to your strength of which you push him and he soars forward. But just kind of talk more about that, or if you want to tell the story, wherever you want to go.
Yeah. I hear you reading that, and I, wow, that is pretty good, isn't it?
It is. It is good. It's really good.
I'm impressed in the moment with myself. I have tried to do that from the beginning, and that is allow your kids to lead is essentially what I was saying in those lines. There are a lot of stories in this book about my parents. I learned my parenting skills, if you can even call them that, by way of my parents, and they let me lead, which oftentimes means making mistakes, sometimes costly mistakes, but it's allowing your children to have be a few steps ahead of you, so to speak. And so that image, and that was an actual moment where I was, you know, pushing him in the swing in the backyard years ago. But I don't want to get in the way of his story. And the same thing with my daughters. I could very easily. And that becomes this kind of parenting / management thing, which is, I don't have those kind of chromosomes. So that's a very difficult thing for me. But I see that often as I look at other families or other parents and kids. And they're always in front of their kids. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yep.
And so they're, it looks like guidance, but I'm afraid at the end of the day, it may be a control type of thing. And I get it. You want your kids to be safe. You want them to make wise decisions. And I mean, I completely understand that stance. But for me at least, and like I said, I learned that from my parents, maybe there's something to being a little behind them. Not far away, so that you're close by, that, you know, if they do fall down, you can pick them up and brush them off or whatever, but you allow them to take their own steps, and that's really what a big part of the parenting journey is. You're presented with these tiny people, and God has a story in store for their lives, and so, you know, a part of the deal is not getting in the way of that story, so that they can become all that they were created to be, and that sounds like a bumper sticker, but I believe that. And so many times there's a lot of restraint that goes on in not getting in the way. And hopefully someday down the road, you know, your kids will be grateful for that style of parenting. I meet a lot of people who are bitter or even resentful of that other brand of just, you know, the parent was always in front of them. And they never got to try anything. They never got to fail, even at least on their own.
Mm-hmm. Now, everyone who's listening, what you need to realize, and again, you really will enjoy the book. But what John does is every chapter is so much story, and then at the end, John, you almost every time you kind of give a sentence or two that emphasizes what kind of, in a sense, the point of the story was or what you were hoping would come across. And so at the end of this story, you said this: reactions tend to shut our children down, but a response keeps the story going. And that's what they really want, is a response, not a reaction. That is just such a great line right there. And I'm sure you just got more impressed with your writing as I read that. Back to you.
Yes, it's you know, it sounds good in writing. Is that hard to do, man? It's tough to do, because if you're in the heat of the moment and you're like any parent on the planet, you know, you have the 10,000 things going on in your life, and then your child presents you with some scenario or a crisis. I mean, the easiest thing to do is just to react, and you can do that with a wife or a husband. You know, and that's the easiest. That's the lowest common denominator kind of reacting there. But a response, and I love that word responsible, if you kind of break it into its two pieces, your response able. We are all able to make a response. We've got that kind of freedom. Now, whether we act on that is another story. But responding to your children and whatever may be going on, it allows that conversation or that story to continue. The other usually shuts it down and people go to their opposite corners. And, you know, it's usually a really quiet household for the rest of the evening, that kind of scenario. And nobody really wants that. those things happen and you say you're sorry and you try to mend the fence and move toward one another once again. But just trying to respond to things. And if I had to say, you know, the theme of this entire book, guys, it's just trying to pay attention to what's going on, because there are these incredibly beautiful gifts. And at one point, and I kind of use that, you know, the title of the book is Know When to Hold Them, and that's taken from that wonderful, you know, Christian song by Kenny Rogers, The Gambler, you know, sung in churches far and wide. But there really is a sense of this, it's a game, and learning how to play that is important. And so you want to keep the game alive. You want to keep the game afoot. And whatever you can try to do in the midst of that by paying attention. And so that's, you know, if you even had to sum up the book in just one line, it's just that. It's just trying to pay attention, which is, by virtue of that phrase, it costs you something. It's a costly endeavor.
So let me ask you a question, John. You're telling the story of swinging your child, and you're sort of singing a little song in your head, and I love the metaphor. You're pushing him away. I mean, you're letting him go free. You're standing behind him. Now, you were talking about this with tiny children, but this is a tiny moment. I mean, this might be 3 minutes of your life particular thing. How do you shut other things down? How do you sort of not listen to all the other things going on in your head? Like, I got to get home, and I got to get dinner ready, and I forgot to take the trash out, and I got to, oh, shoot, that bill's ready. But here you're swinging your child, and you're thinking, I like this. I like the fact that I'm behind him and letting him live his story. I'm not impeding in his story. I'm not controlling his story. How do you shut down some of those other voices and to enjoy that tiny moment with that tiny child and respond, therefore, as opposed to just react?
Yeah. It's practice, Sam. For this one scenario that, you know, was pretty impressive to read, there were seven others where I totally blew it.
I can write those if you want.
You know, I got in front of him and he ran into me and we both fell down and got mad at each other. You know, it's that kind of thing. So it's just practice. But again, it's making a commitment to the game, to show up each time. And you guys know, if you know, whether it's golf or riding or anything like that, you keep on trying, and maybe there are five and six times where you just completely botch it. But then that seventh time comes, and there's that moment. And like you said, it's a tiny, tiny moment, but that's the moment you hold on to. And that's the moment that you want to try to seize. And then hopefully the next time around, it won't come automatically, but at least you've got a baseline to work from.
And maybe it won't take seven swings until the next time. Maybe the next time will come after five swings.
Exactly. And so you're two steps closer to whatever goal it is, which is just trying to be there and present with your kids instead of, like you said, thinking about something else that's going to happen 2 hours in the future or whatever maybe happened earlier the day at work. So it's hard, and so and it's practice, and you have to be pretty graceful with yourself, because it's easy after that fifth time to just say, you know what, just forget this. I can't do it.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, so let me jump ahead for a second, and let me just read another part from your book and go anywhere you want with it. You said. Maybe God's dream is not so much specific as general. It's the father dream, and you put in quotes, go far, I'll help you all I can, end of quote. If that were true, and there was, and there has to be a smidgen of possibility that it is, then think how swallowing that reality might change things. We might give love a second chance and even a third. We might do one more rewrite. Even though we're exhausted, we might dust off the whatever and refuse to let some thief steal our dream. So this idea of that you're talking about, of maybe God's dream is just simply saying, I'm with you, go for it, don't hold back, swing hard. Talk a little more about that.
Yeah, and that's interesting that you read from that. That was one of them that I had picked out to maybe speak from tonight as well. So I wonder sometimes if we get a little overzealous in our specifics when it comes to our kids in terms of what they're to do. And of course, I know I'm talking to the guy who wrote a book on calling.
I like what you wrote. Go.
I think there sometimes when we may overdo that. And, man, I've had moments when I've done that. You know, we have these dreams for our children. We want them to go farther than we have, and we want them to be better at whatever and to be wiser in those situations. But I think sometimes, and I pulled in that thought about, you know, maybe what are God's dreams for us? And I do think God has specific dreams for us. I sure want to believe that. And there seems to be evidence in my life that that is true. But there's also this larger, more general dream that where God says, you know what, whatever you want to do today, Gary or Sam or John or whoever, do it. And I'm right there with you. And so it's that word, Emmanuel, God with us. There was no specific something after that. It's just God's with you, whatever you're doing, so that if your child decides, you know, at some point to study to be, you know, a physicist, that's great. If they decide to do something completely opposite of what you had in store or in mind for them to do, that's great as well. And that hopefully, as a parent, we could try to relate that to our kids, you know, that no matter what you choose to do, that I'm in your corner. I'll be there for you. I'll support you, whatever it is. And I think that's a little, there's a shift there in maybe what has been known as parenting, at least here in the good old U.S. of A, that, you know, you would grow up and your parents would really kind of guide you into something like that, whether it be a vocation, occupation, job, or what have you. But, you know, what is it that your child wants to do? Well, it may be something totally that you've never even thought of or dreamed of, but the commitment to them is it's that same. You're right there, you're close, and you're supporting them. So I hope at some point, and my son turns 17 in February, we'll begin his senior year next year, and our middle daughter is already, you know, fixing to take the ACT, and she's looking at colleges which are miles and miles away from her parents. I'm not sure what that's about, but for both of them, and even our youngest who will start middle school next year, you know, whatever they decide to do, I'm there. Go ahead.
Well, so John, I have a question. I run into men who say, well, I became a doctor because my dad's a doctor, and he wanted me to be a doctor. I became a lawyer. I became a pastor because my dad is a lawyer or a pastor, and, you know, he really motivated me or pressured me or whatever. Why do you think it is that very often our dream for our kids is to do the thing that we wanted to do or do it better? You know, I'm a lawyer of a little company, and I want my son to be a lawyer of a big company. I mean, what is it in us that wants our kids to live out our dream?
Yeah. You know what? I think it's fair for us to want our kids to do that. To hopefully, I think in some sense that, you know, we see them as the second chance, and they can be maybe a better lawyer than we were, or a better teacher or professor or whatever than we were. It feeds into some of our ego, I think. And I don't say that in a negative way. I just think we'd like to see them love to do what we love to do. And so it's some sort of affirmation even of us and what we've chosen as a calling or as a job or occupation. If they were to choose that, you know, would it make me proud if my kids decide to be a writer someday? Yeah, probably. I tell them they probably need, you know, another job at Starbucks or something to pull that off. And I can give them, you know, hard evidence that that's the reality. But it would make me proud. So I think there's something, you know, just to our own, and ego is probably the best word. And again, that's not a negative thing. I just, I think we look at them and hope that they would love the things that we love and want to do the things that we would want to do. And as you all know, that just doesn't always happen. So.
Yeah. You know, John Hard gave a great, he put on the chat line, he said, I wonder if sometimes we aren't trying to get them, our children, to live beyond our regrets. I thought, boy, that was a good way to put that, because that can creep in. John, you and I have a friend that also works at Cook. It's David Burvig. And years ago, maybe a year ago or maybe a couple, he called me and he said, listen, my son is going to turn, I forgot what that, because I don't remember what it was. I don't know how old he was turning. And he said, you know, at his birthday, we're having friends over that have known him, and I'd like to speak something into his life about calling. And I said, you know, David, give me a day or two to really think about this for a minute. And I'm so glad he asked me, because I came back to him a couple days later and I said, David, here's what hits me. If you want your son to walk into the very thing that God has created him to do, this effect that is your son, that's what the world needs, that what makes him come alive and brings life to others, I said, the way you do that is you love him so abundantly, so well, so freely, that he has the courage to try things. He's not afraid of failing and getting slammed for failing. He's not afraid of being ridiculed. He knows that you love him so much and believe in him that, well, it's like your illustration. You're back there saying, I'll push you as hard as you want me to push you. I'll on the swing. I'm with you. I just believe that's true, because as I work with people over the years and get into their stories, the roadblock always comes back to the way that they weren't loved and journeyed well with, and therefore fear is just their constant enemy and companion. I just think that's huge.
Yeah, that's really, really good. I love that, and I agree with you. I do. So my parents did that pretty well with me, and I'm thankful for that. And for a while there, I was kind of hesitant to even share the phrase, but you know what? I don't really have a big father wound. I had a pretty good dad. Now, he wasn't perfect by any means, but he did a pretty good job. And I'm to the point now where I'm very comfortable saying that, not as some sort of a, you know, a pat on the back to me necessarily, but as an honor piece to him. And that, you know what, Dad, and my dad's 74, and it's good for him to hear things like that, that, you know, and we had plenty of times when we butted heads and locked horns and went round and round, that kind of thing. But overall, he did a pretty good job, and he afforded me that kind of permission and freedom and support, and still does. I got an email from him today, and he's got a box of my books in his pickup, and he's driving around Nashville, Arkansas, peddling those things out of the back of his pickup. You know,
I love it.
And I'm just going, wow, well, first of all, I just say thank you, you know, and you're just grateful. And but he's a big fan of me, and that's what I want to be, a fan of my kids. And that's exactly what you were saying there. So, man, I totally agree.
Well, and you said later on in the book, I love this line, you said, with great love comes great responsibility. So with great love comes great responsibility. And then you said, you've been born into a loving family. Now be gentle with people. I believe most people, most folks just want to be loved. Maybe God only knows how much. And I think that's really true. Many of us have grown up in really loving families, and now we have great responsibility with that love to love others that way. So I think you're a great example of that.
And hopefully as you do that – oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, hopefully as you do that, then your kids will turn around and do that in turn. To their spouse and to their kids or to their coworkers or whoever. So and sometimes I get the word legacy gets a little cloudy for me, because I'm not always sure what that means. But in that scenario, that is something, a legacy that you want to leave, and that is is loving people and being kind and gentle to people. Because, yeah, I mean, I have not found a single person on the planet who refuses gentleness. I just haven't.
Right, that's a good point.
Now, sometimes you have to present it, you know, in a certain way. But everybody opens themselves to that in the moment. So.
Yeah. You know, so I have to tell everybody. So John and I both spoke at different sessions at a retreat. I think it was 2 years ago. As I told you earlier, it was Vance Brown's retreat, Banner Brothers, and it was at his retreat center, Bear Trap Ranch. And so what I discovered was that John had the first session on a particular morning, and I had the session right after him. And so when he gets up to speak, he said, I mean, basically your point, John, in that talk was, and it's in a chapter in your book, you know, what's wrong with just being a good man? You know, we've really kind of, you were talking about someone talked about living this awesome life or extraordinary, awesome, whatever it was, you know, and why have we lost this idea of just living a good life? And when God created something and it was pure and it was powerful, he called it good and so on. So I'm hearing him speak going, oh, this is great. Now I'm going to stand up after this and say there is something extraordinary that God has made you to do. And luckily I found that verse in Luke where, you know that there are good things stored up in our heart that we're supposed to bring, you know, to the world. And it had good in it three times. So at least I used the verse that had good in it three times. I felt like I established my place here. But I so love what you said. And so I want to read another part that you read. I'd love you to talk about this. You said, I've heard, especially in the Christian community, that it's not enough just to be a good man, that you've got to be God's man or something like that. Maybe that's why I believe most of the loud male Christian voices know precious little about the soul of a man, let alone their own soul. So say a little more, and then you said the world needs good men. Just say a little more about that whole thing.
Yeah. I just hear that a lot. I work in Christian publishing, and so I read a number or many times stacks of proposals every week from young, not so young, and even older communicators. And there's always this push to be that kind of an epic man or this grand, you know, figure. And it's usually always couched in, and I don't know if there's anything necessarily bad about that, but it's usually always couched in the God language, and that's what God really wants from you. And I can understand that, especially as a young man. I mean, you want to establish yourself, and you want to strive to be heroic in the things that you do. But at some point, we've lost that word good, and that was the point that I was trying to make on that day. And I remember you following up after that, and you did a fantastic job of complimenting what we were both really talking about, the same thing. It's just trying to redefine this word good. It's kind of fallen on hard times.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do a word search, even in the Old Testament, the word good, it would amaze you how many times it's there, and that's the ideal. I even use... in that talk on that day, you know, the childhood prayer. God is great. God is good. Let us thank him for our food. God's the only one who has pulled off this great and good combination. And for us, maybe, you know, our efforts to be the great, we may be flying a little too close to the sun. and maybe we were just created to be good. But maybe that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And to try to be a good man, I would love for people to stand at my graveside one of these days and say, you know what, John was a good man. If that's the case, and I'm looking down from heaven or, you know, wherever spatially heaven is, if I'm in a cornfield in Iowa with Kevin Costner, you know, wherever heaven is, if someone says about my life, you know, John was a good man. What a wonderful, wonderful thing. And then in that, however you see that scenario playing out where God says, well done, my good, and faithful servant. I don't know. Like I said, I understand the epic, awesome thing and the heroic striving. I get all that, and I struggle with all that. Even to this day, I'm in my mid-40s. But there's something about being a good man that I think is, and it sounds old-fashioned, you know, stable, trustworthy, someone who perseveres, and then all of a sudden, you know what, you're really close to something called the fruits of the Spirit. But they all move in this direction of a good man. And the same applies to a woman, a good woman. Mm-hmm. You know, every man wants a good woman, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do, and it means something. So that's kind of a minority position in our world today. And even in what, you know, this small thing called the Christian culture, which is full of bright lights and celebrities and all that kind of stuff, what's wrong with being a good man? You know what? Absolutely nothing. And if we had a few more good men, I don't know, things might look a little bit differently. So,
yeah. So what does it mean to you? So unpack that a little bit more. What does it mean to you to be a good man? If people are talking at your graveside, which I hope is not very soon, and they're describing what it means that John was just a good, not just, but he was just a good man. What are they meaning?
I think one of the things, Sam, would be the word faithful or even the word fidelity. That John was faithful to what was entrusted to him in this life. And I believe that all of us, men, women, you know, that we're entrusted with things. In our discussion right now, we're talking about children. You're entrusted with these children for a certain length of time. And are you faithful to them? And what does that mean? You know, did you stay close? Did you support them? Did you love them in season and out of season kind of thing? Even in terms of marriage, and these things don't always work out, but you go into it with a commitment to fidelity. And you know what? There's something good about that. So faithfulness, and as I mentioned, the fruit of the Spirit a minute ago, that's usually not seen as the most masculine list in the Scriptures. In fact, for a while, I was just not too impressed with it. I thought, wow, that sounds kind of soft. But the older I get, there's a lot of strength there. You just have to scratch the surface a little bit to get to that. And that maybe one of the, you know, one of the strongest things is to be faithful and to stick with it, whatever that may mean and whatever your scenario and situation looks like. But gentleness. Man, does it take strength to be gentle? Oh, wow. You know, the easy thing is just to lash out or to, you know, rear back and punch somebody or something. Incredible strength to be gentle. So I'd probably point to that list through the Spirit and say, you know what, those are the good things. And again, those all sound old-fashioned. But I'm to the point where I love that, and I love being old-fashioned. And if someone has a problem with that, you know, my response is it's a tough life.
yeah.
You know, I think you'll survive. But so some of those things, I know I'm not exactly answering your question,
this is really helpful.
But
good.
But those things are good. But I just don't hear that stuff very much anymore.
Right, you don't. And as you're saying this, John, what I'm thinking, what I'm remembering is there are times when I want to pay a compliment to a person I know. He's not in front of me. Someone's asking me about this person. And the most profound and weighty compliment I can give that person is to say, he is a good man, mm-hmm. or she is a good woman. And that's far deeper than going, oh, they're so good at this, and they're, I just feel like, you know, at least when I'm saying it, I feel like I can't reach anything deeper than that. That's just such a deep thing, that, and it says so much. So I agree. Yeah, Alex Thompson writes on here, he says that even the Marines are looking for a few good men. So they could boil it down to that one thing. So I thought that was good.
Okay, and you know what? It's also... it's also that honoring piece to our fathers, and that's a huge thing with me. And so many of us have difficulties with fathers, and, you know, they weren't affectionate, or they didn't say I love you and all those kinds of things. And we know all that. But there were a lot of men who were our fathers and grandfathers, and some of them even passed now. And you know what? They tried to live the life of a good man in their context, and whatever that looks like in the history of America or Kansas or wherever you were, there was a commitment on their part. I really believe that, to try to be a good man. Well, some of it misguided and it got screwed up and all. Sure, you get that. But being able to even someday say to a father or a grandfather, you know what, you were a good man. Mm-hmm. Those words are golden to hear, and
yeah.
and you realize that as you age a little bit. So
yeah. Okay, so I'm going to put you on the spot here for a minute. Again, I realize you actually finished writing this book a year ago, so I'm going to ask you about a specific.
So okay.
If you need to yell uncle, you need to tap out on this one, just do it, okay? So can you tell us, you know, in chapter 32, you talk about five things. For instance, I'll give you the first one. So are you with me? Are you tracking with me, or you want me to give you the first one?
I got the book right here, so go ahead.
Okay. So walk us through these five things. It was so powerful, and like you said, five things, like you think of your hand, that's a handful right there. You can't do much more with something than a handful. So you have five things. Talk to us about those five things.
The first one there is that it's good to love. And again, some of this feeds into, well, there are things that my dad taught me, or that I watched him do. And let me make that a very clear point. My father was not always the most verbal dad, but I watched him. He modeled things in a very clear way. And so as he fathered me, you know, I was just watching him. And I think he had an awareness of that. He probably didn't know everything to say in the moment. And sometimes, especially as dads, we kind of get tripped up in not knowing the right words. But he modeled those things. And my dad was a pastor for 50 years. He just recently retired. But he loved people. And, you know what, it's kind of like the end of the film It's a Wonderful Life. All these people show up, you know, in George Bailey's household there to bail him out of the situation that he's in, because he loved people. And I could see that same kind of scenario happening if, you know, my dad got in some sort of financial crisis or something. There'd be people coming out of the literal woodwork to help this guy because he loved them. He loved them well. And that's a huge thing. It's incredibly difficult to do some days, but it's just good to love people and start in close. You know, that begins with spouse, kids, or neighbor, or whatever. You know, as Anne Lamott said about forgiveness, you know, don't start out trying to forgive Hitler. You know, start with something a little smaller than that. And the flip side of the coin is in terms of loving, love those people close in. Second thing is, it's good to have.
Let me quote one more thing from you on that point. Yeah. I thought this was so well said. You said, "Folks remember little of what you say or do, but they do remember what you love." That's just a powerful thing. They remember what you love, and I think that's really true. That's what you tend to remember. So, okay.
And you know what? That's what you get at a funeral when people stand up and do eulogies.
Mm.
They talk about what this person loved.
True.
When they're reading about, you know, Sam was the CEO of, you know, whatever corporation, that's always kind of, it's just statistics, and the room is a little bit cold. But you start talking about the things that Sam loved, you know, and he loved to, I don't know, he made homemade slingshots or whatever. You know, I don't even know what Sam does, but what are the things that Sam loved? And then everybody starts, you know, nodding their heads, and they say, yeah. And the room warms up. People remember what you love. So,
yeah. Good.
My dad taught me that it's good to have some heroes besides Jesus. and I have no doubt in my mind that that my dad loves Jesus, and he showed me that example as well. But I think it's good to have heroes who've got feet of clay. And I often say, and have written in other places, that my dad raised me on the King James Bible and Western movies, cowboy movies, so that, you know, I grew up with the 23rd Psalm and Bible drills and, I mean, the whole nine yards, and all that was in kind of a weird combination with John Wayne and Rawhide and all this kind of stuff. And so most of my dad's heroes are cowboys. And I grew up with those same kind of heroes. And in this piece, I mentioned James Arness, who was Marshall Dillon, you know, from Gunsmoke, and he had just died when I wrote this. But I don't think that's a bad thing to have some heroes. You can get into hero worship, and I understand all that. But from where I'm writing or where I'm standing, that's a practice in being vulnerable. And it's saying, you know what? Gary Barklow is a hero of mine. Now, is Gary Barklow going to disappoint me at some point? Well, the reality is, yeah, probably along the way there. You know, if not once, twice, or three times, or whatever. But it's still good to have, it's still good to think, you know what? Gary is a hero of mine. And I look to him, or I learn from him. And it's just a thing that I learned from my dad. And I can remember in that situation when James Arness died that my dad cried because that was one of his heroes. And so all of a sudden there you have the presence of tears, which for a man are incredibly, they speak volumes, you might say. And so that feeds back into that number one, you know, it's good to love people. So even if they're characters on a television show. number three, it's good to be moved to tears. And I tell a story of my dad and my brother and I. We were actually up in Estes Park, Colorado, and the film True Grit had just come out. And we grew up watching the old True Grit with John Wayne and, you know, Glenn Campbell. And I'm hoping you guys have some sort of resonance with that example.
Yeah.
But, you know, they did the new one, and so there was a soundtrack. Anyway, we listened to these. And the soundtrack is old hymns that Carter Burwell just, oh, man, did a fantastic job. And so we were just sitting there, and all the stuff just, all of a sudden, all three of us were, you know, were misty-eyed. And, you know, we weren't down in the floor convulsing or anything like that. We just, but they were tender tears, that there was something going on there between the three of us, and that music and the memories there of, you know, watching that old Western time and time again. And we didn't have to say a word. It was just the tears, and that's what they spoke. And you get that in different, you know, you get a bunch of veterans together, and they talk about serving somewhere together on some front. And you know what? If they talk long enough, a couple of guys will get misty-eyed. Mm-hmm. And that's a beautiful thing. And again, you know, nobody was like losing control necessarily, but I tend to define tears as liquid love, and that love starts spilling out of your eyeballs, and I don't know, it means something. And so number four, it's good to go easy on folks. I know the tough love stance, and I've got a 17-year-old son. I mean, I understand that kind of thinking. There was one incident of Jesus kicking over everything in the temple, you know, and heads rolling and people scrambling out. But there's just that one singular incident. And if you look at the other moments and interactions that Jesus had with people, he kind of went easy on them. Even the Pharisees sometimes, I think, you know, we always see them as being this very antagonistic type of scenario. But if you go back and look at those moments, he was kind of playful with the Pharisees at times, but he went easy on folks. And that ties back into all these dovetail over, you know, with each other. There's just something about being gentle with people. And I heard this story the other day. and it was a very famous trumpet player. And it's a fictional story, obviously, but he was up on stage, and he laid a handful of walnuts out on this table, and he stood in front of those walnuts there. And anyway, he asked the folks, how do you crack these nuts, so to speak, and had a guy come up with a hammer, and he did his job, and then somebody else came up, who had an incredible grip, and he put them in his hand, and he cracked them with his hands. And then the guy, put some fresh walnuts out on the table there, and he pulls out his trumpet, and he begins to play this gentle, gentle song, melody and rhythm and all that kind of, just this beautiful piece coming out of the end of this trumpet, and the nuts just crack themselves out of gentleness. So that there's this, this hard way that we often want to take, but then there's this other piece that, as I said earlier, it may take even more strength and more thought and more focus, and that is to go gentle. But that seems to be the piece that is enduring, and that is the piece that people remember. So, and last but not least, number five, it's good to remember God speaks through the sacred, and I believe that every stitch of our lives is sacred. So that means that God speaks through every stitch of our lives. It's not just something that happens in some building, like a church, or it's not something that just happens somewhere on a retreat. And so that's part of this paying attention things with your children. You do that with your children, but you also do that with your spouse and with your friends and whoever that is, that all throughout the day, there are very sacred things going on if we can see them. And you have to practice at that, and you'll fail some. But there are those times when you can see that, and it's just it's beautiful. And all right, I would love when the end comes for me. And this is, was this the third time that I'm referring to my demise in this conversation? This is a little bit morbid. Then when the end comes, and it will, I would hope that I could smile and say my, and mean it. That you'd look back on your life, and that the primary thing would not be, regret or sadness or something like that, but that you'd gone through this whole show, and as best you could, you'd caught those moments along the way, so that you'd look back in gratitude and then turn forward and look in anticipation. And that sounds really good on paper, and even sounds kind of poetic as I say it there, but I believe that. And I try to live that way. That's the five things. And man, if you check those off the list, you're way ahead of the game. So,
well, there's in a sense there's the definition of a good man or a good woman.
Yeah, it really may be. So
Well, okay, this has been really good. I would love for you to end with one more thing.
Okay.
And that is, you have a chapter where you talk about this, just really one word, and the word is breathe, right? Just breathe. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, and we'll end with that idea.
Can you tell me what chapter that is?
And hurry up, because I'm holding my breath.
You know what? On the digital book, it's a page 1,134, so I don't know what it is in your book. I can read you a quote from it.
Let's see. Oh, I got you. Okay. You want me just to read it?
Yeah.
You got time?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. 4 a.m. I'm a very early riser, so a lot of these things get written early in the morning. So 4 a.m., I stepped out on the back stoop to wake myself up, to splash my bare chest with cold. Everything inside was agog with moon glow. I looked up and into the night's full sun, and out of that splendid orb came a voice I believed to be God's. And God said, tell the parents to breathe. And so that's what I'm doing. Breathe. Don't hold your breath any longer. Begin to exist today fully. Begin today to inhale and exhale the fullness of you. We half exist most days based on contingencies. I'll begin when the kids are grown and gone, or when we're in better financial shape, or when there is consensus on the team. We are a blue-faced race, holding our breath most days, waiting and waiting. Why? At the risk of offending or inspiring you, I'll wager an answer. That's because we're afraid. Holding back is the mortal sin of omission, a fearful half-existence of omitting our very selves from a world dappled with divine grace, a pinching, held breath, stumbling through day after day, grasping at the black hope of one of these days, and all too often that day never comes. Or when it finally does, it's over, and we stand before the night's full sun, and the voice comes from inside that splendid orb and asks, why were you afraid? In that moment, our bare bodies will be splashed with the cold ache of stillborn life. Oh, there will be mercy, no doubt, but it will be mercy bittered with regret. So my final word there is breathe. And hopefully that is a very freeing word for parents. We carry so much weight, and we see our relationships, especially those of our children, as weight. And I wonder sometimes, you know, as you said earlier, Gary, we're wanting our children to just go and be their full selves. And the best gift that we can give to our children is to be our full selves as mothers and fathers or grandfathers or whatever the case might be, and to just breathe, that we're not the end-all of all things, that there is a good Father who is constantly has us in his sights and in his hand and in his heart, and so that maybe we could relax just a little bit. it's just, I don't know. The best way to handle heavy things is to try to make them a little bit lighter. And so could we as parents, as fathers, as mothers, could it be a little bit more lighthearted and breathe a little bit more? And I think our kids will pick up on that. They'll see that and in turn maybe begin to breathe a little bit more themselves.
Yeah. Well, I just took a big breath. I just realized that after you got done saying that. I just think that's such a great way to end this whole thing, this particular conversation, because, you know, the stories that you share, it really does feel like there is a lightness through it. You just realize, you know, the grace of God, the lightness of walking through this world and raising children with God. I just think the idea of breathing is just such a great picture. Like the first one of pushing your child on a swing, and I think this is a great ending, you know, metaphor and picture of just breathe now. You know, it's okay.
Yeah.
So, John, thank you. This has been really fun. And everyone, I'm really glad that John read that one chapter, because that's what the whole book is like. You need to get it. It's really good. And I'm so glad you wrote this book. Thank you.
Well, thank you all very much for the time this evening. I appreciate being on, and you did a great interview. Well, let me say, you did a good interview.
Wait a minute, wasn't it
epic,
awesome?
Or, you know what? It was very, very good, and I thoroughly enjoyed the time. And yeah, hopefully, you know, the folks who are listening in will maybe heard something that would inspire them and give a little bit of hope. That's the whole goal. You know, faith, hope, and love. The greatest of these is love. But you know what? Hope ain't too shabby, man. And anytime you can instill a little hope in someone, that's a good day. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Very true. So, John, thank you. It's been a great conversation.
You are very, very welcome. All right.
Sam,
hope y'all have a great evening.
Thanks for doing this
with
me. All right. You too. See ya.
All right. Thanks, Gary. Thanks, Sam.
Yep.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.